The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. Right now, my headphone of choice is the Dual Driver ANC Pro neckband. Great battery life, punchy dynamic sound, and crazy good noise reduction in a very convenient just drop your earbud neckband design. Or you can get those same features and completely cut the cords with the Dual Driver ANC True Wireless, one of the absolute best options in the completely cable-free space. Or maybe you want to fill a decently large room with a pair of One More portable Bluetooth speakers. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY with no spaces. And you'll save an additional 20% on these already competitive prices. You'd spend over $80 less on One More's Dual Driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com. And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout to save big. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another Monday morning tech chat show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, also known as Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this horribly named podcast series. But the Q&A, of course, stands for question and answer, as we like to take a sort of a continuing and evolving look at the news stories that happen in tech. I like to hold my show on a Monday so we can kind of sort out our feels on the news of the week that happened before us. And then we can also keep an eye on what's going on. We're not just going to get hung up on a headline. We're going to try and dig a little bit deeper and kind of keep up with stories as they evolve. But this week, I'm feeling pretty chill. I've got a list of links that we could talk about. There's some tech and politics. There's some tech and security, privacy stories, stuff like that. And I feel we can kind of move through those too. But I really want to the week leading into Christmas. This is being recorded on the 21st, and we're kind of getting into the big show, the big week for celebrating the holidays. Let's have a chill pajama podcast. You know, let's hang out, let's chat, let's talk. I've got already seeing a wonderful list of folks in the live chat, some really familiar names. ER1980, Heyki, My Tech Review, It's Thexy, Pat, Andy, Marlink P, Alsbachley, Q3, Becker, Mbuku. We've Fat Produce. Hey, we've got the whole crew. We've got a great crew. I kind of also want to spend some time. Let's just chat out some of the stuff that's been keeping us sane these last couple weeks and these last couple months. If you've been watching some good TV, if you've got a prime edition for a holiday film, a holiday movie. I'm going to take a drink of water here. I'm only on one actual cup of coffee right now, and I probably should have hit it a little bit harder than that. But yes. We've been in this madcap zany race to try and make this holiday season feel a little more special. I'm sure the experiences in my family are going to echo a number of folks out there, where this year is going to be a little bit different. We were really trying to sort out the logistics. Back in the summer, my mom was really hyped up on, let's see if we can't find some way where we could all like shelter in place and try and do this safely. But especially with numbers on the rise again, we kind of scrapped all of those holiday travel plans. Excuse me. And we're sad about that. I mean, there's definitely something sad going from Thanksgiving to Christmas and trying to do holidays on video conference call software. But we're also all feeling good with that decision where it doesn't make sense to take unnecessary risks right now. So we're going to hunker down. The issue with that is, you know, Marie and I have a five-year-old and it's a single child household, and we're trying to find those fun things that we can do to make some of this feel special still. It's difficult, you know, like it's the head trip that you go through. We're trying to make some of these times still feel special, trying to still make some memories when the day-to-day life of just being kind of cooped up at home kind of blurs all of the days together. And it's got to be really frustrating for a very adventurous, outgoing, and precocious five-year-old. So we're still trying to figure out some of those things that we might try to do to make this feel a little bit more fun, or to go on some family adventures, take some time with Marie and I still working from home. I don't think she also understands that, like, you know, these are stay home days, but they're not days off. So it's definitely been an interesting turn this year as we get into the end of this year. And again, I've got an email inbox just full of like CES announcements and stuff. We're already gearing up for the commerce of 2021 and what we're going to do to hype up some fun tech and to talk about some of these new stories. So it's definitely a challenge. Yeah, I don't feel like we're really going to get the same quality of time off because we've just been at home and we're kind of in that work at home kind of vibe. Hey, we got TK. Oh, we got Paul. We've got Warhead, all Greg. I don't know if I'm missing anyone here. But let's at least kind of go through some of the trappings of the show. We'll crank out some, we'll do some housekeeping here, because a lot of stuff went out on the internet, and then we can kind of hang out. I think this is, I'm feeling very loose, so this is going to be a sort of a rambling exploratory conversation. I hit up questions and stuff. We can also use this as a year end or a wrap up kind of podcast. Well, not really. I'm still going to do another show next week. You know the gig. But yes, Alsbachley, I am aiming for this to be a fun conversation. We're going to try and have a good time. Paul, what is up? Oh, man. Paul just gifted out a bunch of tier one subs. Thank you so much, Paul, for supporting production on this channel and contributing to the SGG community. That was really awesome of you. Thank you. And happy holidays. And everyone who just got one, happy holidays. All right, so let me kick this over here. Actually, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do just a couple of the other video highlights first. So this is the time of year as everyone's wrapping up content on their channels. I still have one other video that I think I want to try and put out like either like Christmas Eve or right before, maybe right after Christmas. Just my experiences of like the phone of the year, the best phones of 2020. So I got to throw a shout out. My buddy TK Bay put together a great collection of content creators to talk about their favorite tech of 2020. Mine was definitely audio related and a bit more philosophical. But there's, again, it's just really great seeing all these faces because we didn't get to go in any trade shows this year. So, these are all my work friends, and this was probably the best way to kind of hang out, even though we didn't really get to hang out. But yeah, I would definitely take a gander through this video. And again, I know all of these people are doing these like chapters, and I need to figure out, because I've added time codes to my videos. I want to know, like, yeah, see, I mean, I've done this before with time codes, and the chapters never seem to show up on my videos. I need to figure out how to fix that. But I digress. You should watch this video. It's got Josh Vergara, Enabong, Salah, Superstaff, me. I think that's Max. You know, just a bunch of really cool people who let's actually go through. Ahmed, Android Basha, Brett, Mr. Q, And of course, TK Bay himself. So really, really lovely video to put together and some really good times. I also took a stop on Tana So Lit, Tana's YouTube channel. He wanted to do a 2020 Phones of the Year. And this one, I got a little wacky with the premise because I genuinely don't believe there was a phone of the year in 2020. So some great content creators in here, just some really cool folks talking about what their favorite phones of 2020 or what they think the best phone of 2020 was. I had to be a contrarian. So I said, no, Tana, no. But no, I was going to check it out. I mean, you've got great representation from some of the top premium options. I just kind of had to be persnickety and say, I'm not going to play your game. Aditya Anil, Tana made a video. My notifications are messed up. I need to watch that. And again, yeah, you can smash that bell icon. If it's a channel like mine or even like a channel like Tana's, it's very unlikely Google really is serving up those recommendations. Juan was going to recommend the Fold 2 as the phone of the year 2020. No. I have done a few other. So, I mean, like, I've got a couple other friend videos that are going to be going out. Like, I'm gonna pop in on Nick Gray. He's doing a Fandroid wrap up with a bunch of content creators. Like, I think Shannon Morse is still going to be doing her wrap up video, kind of best tech trends of 2020. Rolando, I'm gonna shoot something for him like real quick after this podcast, and you'll see me pop up in a couple other combo collaborations. But yeah, you know, for as much as I position my, I don't believe there was a phone of the year, I absolutely wouldn't have been Fold 2, even for my favorite phone of the year. From McCorcoran, I would still pick the Pixel 4a just for the value proposition and the ease of recommendation to a wide variety of users. I would have no problems recommending a Pixel to my senior citizen mother or to a tech-loving Generation Z enthusiast. This is where it kind of comes back, though, to the video that I tried to put out about smartphone categories. I put out a video just saying, like, one of the main philosophical issues we have with reviewing is like we categorize on these very broad price tiers. Is this a mid-ranger? Is this entry level? Is this a flagship? Is it a premium flagship? Or is it the flagship product of a mid-tier company that sells budget handsets? Do you only call it the flagship if it's the best of that manufacturer? Or do you call it a flagship if it's, you know, over $1,000? That's exhausting. I just think that's a terrible way to talk about consumer electronics. And so one of the things that I really felt, and I've said this, like I've said this in Tana's video on phones, is once you start categorizing the phone as a platform for a specific consumer, then you see very clearly how great 2020 was for offering up a broader variety of hardware and solutions. And I'm definitely more a hardware guy. So, you know, when I see hinges and when I see swivels and when I see folding screens and when I see modular concepts and stylus support and small form factor phones becoming more vogue again. One of the links I have is on the Pixel 5 actually doing pretty well this year, which again, the Pixel 5 launched at a lower price than the Pixel 4 and it seems to be selling better. Who would have thunk it? It's a total shock and surprise to me. That's crazy. No one could have predicted that a sort of a top option from a manufacturer coming in at a lower price would do better. Anyway, like putting all those together, it's just, this was such a fun year for kind of scouting out what niche audience was being better supported. From Alice Bockley, the video made about that one made my friend opt for the 4A instead of an expensive flagship, and given his usage, it was the right decision. I'm really happy to hear that, especially this time of year where I'm in a really overly sentimental state. we're going to get through the rest of housekeeping, and maybe we'll get through the rest of housekeeping. Maybe the entire podcast is just going to be me failing to get through housekeeping. But especially as I've been looking back on my own year and the tech that I thought was really important and the incredible circumstances that we've all been living through, as I'm being really self-reflective, and it's the kind of the right time of year for that inward analysis. Now, it makes me really happy to hear when folks start better considering what it is they need, what it is they want, and then looking at some of the budgets and understanding that, you know, if you're not going to be one of those individuals who wants to push a phone to laptop grade use, why are you out there shopping at the premium tier of the market? You know, it's like we can kind of figure this out in other industries. It's like if you're not really working in construction, why are you trying to buy that like super expensive dually turbo diesel? Or, you know, if you're not skilled enough to handle some kind of exotic sports car, why would you try and pick one of those up? You know, like we grok this, and for some reason in phones it's still like, hey, I'm gonna review this $1,000 phone, but what about the bare minimum average consumers? They won't like this phone. It's just so galling, you know. Yes, I know you're trying to target the broadest consumer market, and I understand, like, you want the biggest audience for your video, so that's who you're catering to. But why would you ever put these devices up? And then again, of course, like, because broadly, you know, they're going to buy more Apple and Samsung. Well, it's okay if Samsung does like $1,000 phone. It's okay when Apple does $1,000 phone. But these other companies, they're just not worth it enough. It's so obvious. It's so frustrating. It only took me 15 minutes to fall into my pattern of obviously manipulated YouTube algorithm, ad revenue influenced consumer tech influencers. So let's finish up housekeeping. One of the highlights of my week was also a show called The Best of Our Week, where I think TK and I might try and make this a regular thing. I don't know if TK's still in the live chat, but we jumped on a co-stream together. He streamed on YouTube, I streamed here on Twitch, and I kind of feel like this is something we both sort of need. We're both in that mindset of trying to stay sane and kind of collaborate and work together on things, and we can't do that the way that we normally would. So, you know, maybe an hour long or a 90-minute stream a week, where the whole premise is sharing with an audience and with some friends, some like-minded tech enthusiasts, just what was the best of our week. I feel like that's enough for a show. We don't need to be trying to cram every minute of every stream with hot takes and these are the facts, and we're going to spit out news and what do you think about this development? Like, maybe we just need something a little friendlier, a little bit more chill. So we're going to play with a few more. I think we're even going to try a few over the holidays, like before Christmas and before New Year's, just to see, like, if that's something folks are interested in. I hope it's a stream or an idea that you know, folks want to participate with and they want to check that kind of stuff out and join us. Again, just like this podcast, I really want it to be, you know, interactive. I really want it to be, you know, something that people can contribute to. At the same time, as we just get to have a fun time geeking out with some fun friends. So that be on the lookout for some other examples of some stuff that might be kind of interesting to shake things up. I'm really thinking, you know, like, again, outside of just making more fodder for YouTube, that's the kind of thing I really want to turn into an audio-facing podcast that really can kind of live on its own. You know, it can be the Juan and TK show, and yeah, we'll stream it on our various platforms, or maybe we'll come up with new channels if the show takes off or if you folks like it. But I really like that really low audience effort. You put it into a podcast player, you run some chores, you run some errands, you're just kind of hanging out, you're trying to get some work done, and we can all sit down together and have a fun chat, just being geeks and nerds together. So, yeah, Best of Our Week is the name of the show. And if you like it, please give it some likes and shares and support it. And maybe it's a thing that we'll be able to keep up on the regular. So, let's scroll through a few more of these before we wrap up. Before we move on. Nick Fell, isn't it pretty straightforward? Flagship, only the Halo product. That would be the Wing for the LG, the Fold 2 for Samsung, et cetera, et cetera. No, you would think it would be easy. That already, I would say, nope. The Wing isn't a flagship. It's an experimental tier of phone. The Fold 2 isn't really a mainstream product. It's not, it's a crown jewel tech delivery thing. But again, it's the words have taken on no meaning. You know, the flagship product from LG and the one that I think sold the best, and, you know, you would look at something like a V60. So then what does flagship mean for power? What does flagship mean for price? What does flagship mean for features? And none of that stays consistent from manufacturer to manufacturer to manufacturer. Whatever term you deign flagship would change. So how do you compare products using that word? You can't. So that's why I've given up. I will talk about communicator phones and productivity phones and gaming phones and, you know, sort of some of these consumer all-rounders. It's, you know, content production platforms. That at least points us in a direction where if two phones are making the same claims, like an Xperia 1 Mark II and an LG V60, we have a common frame of reference for why we're comparing them. And that's kind of how I'm going to have to keep moving through 2021. McCorkorin 3, it's interesting that the Pixel 5 was voted best phone of the year on Android Authority. It's almost like the Pixel 5 is a pretty good phone, even though tech reviewers like bagging on Google phones. It's a total mystery. It's almost like the outside popularity of the Pixel 5 has very little to do with the insulated echo chamber of Android tech reviewers. I'm not better. hold on. There were a couple other. McGorkorin, your rants about YouTube tech influencers are why we watch. Well, I'm glad some folks enjoy those, because I get a lot of hate on larger, more populous platforms, especially certain subreddits. Q3 Brecker, but in all seriousness, the Pixel 4a is probably the best device for most people. Yeah, okay. Again, when your criteria is, I want to cover the sort of the core experience of apps, communications, and phone calls. I should say social media, communications, and phone calls. The Pixel 4a is an absolute monster. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's just a price performance beast. And it's capable of pushing into some higher tiers of use. Like, I have no qualms using it to shoot, edit, and render very short, punchy little family 4K videos. Like, it's handy for that. From there, if the consumer you're talking to is interested in some higher degree of use or action or activity, then that's where we start talking about moving up the food chain, moving to more expensive devices. And that's why I feel this conversation needs to be sort of defined better. Aditya Anil, I successfully convinced a friend who was indifferent about Die Hard before that it's a Christmas movie thanks to you. Gracias, mi amigo. Your friend, at least congratulate your friend for being open-minded, because I'm still running into a handful of those comments from people. We're going to talk about this because that is part of housekeeping still. It's 9:23. We're still doing housekeeping. I put out a video defending Die Hard as a Christmas movie. I supplied evidence. It's not just me going, oh, there's a Santa hat in that one scene, so it's a Christmas film. No. They're thematically, the Die Hard is a Christmas movie. And of course, I've got a bunch of people. No, it's just set at Christmas. It's not a Christmas movie. And you're like, you said, nah, brah. You didn't provide any arguments. So I win and you're incorrect. Oh, ER1980 with a highlighted message. Dr. Ian Cutress on his Tech Potato channel did an interesting long 40-minute video in relation to relationships between manufacturers, reviewers, journalists, content creators. It was quite an interesting watch. Video is titled How to Not Be the Ultimate Shill. For the audio version of this podcast, Ian is getting my mid-podcast shout-out. So every week on the audio version, I try to highlight a content creator that I think is doing cool work. And I've been cycling through them for a while. I finally pinned Dr. Cutress down on doing a shout out. So his is going to be the audio shout out in the audio pod, the shout out in the audio version of this podcast this week. Spoiler, for those of you listening on the audio podcast, you're about to hear him in the middle of the show talk about Tech Potato. I'm a big fan. I really like his work. And we've had a bunch of fun conversations. The very first time we met, we got into not a heated discussion, but as I was somewhat inebriated at a Huawei event. And we got kind of into a tiff about 4K displays. And I'm still of the mind, you know, give me the maximum resolution for the people with the absolute best eyesight and make that the normalized peak display technology. And then from there, we're done. Like, once you have around a UHD resolution at about a 6-inch display, visual acuity of the human eye when you're measuring the arc minutes and the distance, the minimum focusing distance to the human face, you cannot get better than that. Like, the human eye will not perceive anything better than that. And so we're done. Like, we can just finish this. And then he was talking about power management and you know, the toll it takes on battery life. But now we're using high refresh rate displays. I mean, it was just a great, like, kind of sparring back and forth. I do this with a lot of people, you know, like Litchfield and Dr. Cutress. But ever since then, I've just genuinely enjoyed following his work on Anantech. And then when Tech Potato came out, it was a lot of fun seeing him in a different format, you know, putting together sort of a more vlog style video stream. So I would definitely recommend checking him out. And the audio shout out, he'll be on the podcast. From Paul Burry, without the action, Die Hard would be on the Hallmark Channel. I love it. Hold on, let me just scan through a few more of these here real quick, and then we'll whatever the joke of this is as housekeeping. There were a couple things that I got out this week that I really enjoyed. These are probably videos that are going to tank. They're already tanking on YouTube. I think YouTube is kind of proper giving up on me. Every time I log in, it's like, well, you didn't get as many views as you did yesterday, so we're watching your stats fall. Tisk tisk. And like, I'm making videos that I'm having fun with. So the first video, use your phone to make better holiday videos. Just another kind of fun video primer. I feel like there's an immediacy and there's a brevity to smartphone video editing that I still don't feel this is getting across. I talked to my family and friends. Yeah, they all seem super intimidated by the idea, or that like video editing is something only fancy people do with really expensive workstation computers. I couldn't do that. And so the focus is on mobile, but I also throw a shout out and a plug to DaVinci Resolve. Why not get some of the best video editing software you could use, and it's free. So I put that video together, just some tips and tricks, some things that have kind of helped me, you know, sort of, you know, mentally plan out how I edit on the go. But then also just kind of highlighting what some of the just kind of highlighting what I think some of the benefits are. So moving right along, to kind of go hand in hand with that, Rode sent out their vlogger kit. Both TK and I had some really nice things to say about this kit on the Best of Our Week first episode. And it's a handy little collection of parts and pieces. It's a tripod and a phone mount and a cold shoe. I called it a hot shoe mount in my video, and I'm super embarrassed by that. It's not powered. It's a cold shoe. But, you know, they also supply a little LED light and a microphone with a windsock. I did some comparisons between, like, phone microphones and windy conditions and this Rode little micro mic. And just how well considered it is. You know, there are a bunch of like really cheap accessories packages, and I think that's why we're maybe a little gun shy whenever a company comes out with like a, this is a kit for vloggers. It's usually some awful selfie stick and like a ring light, you know, something that you really wouldn't want to use outside of just the most low effort talking to your selfie camera kind of content. And instead, I kind of feel like my biggest criticism in the video is Rode shouldn't have called this a vlogger kit. The tripod is great. The ball head is great. The phone mount is great. The dual bracket cold shoe mount is great. The light is pretty decent. It's not a bad little LED lamp. The microphone is solid. I mean, these are all very well considered and all put together. So you can catch that whole review where I actually kind of check all that stuff out. So, Nick Fell, that's not a windsock, it's a dead cat. Windsocks measure wind direction at airports. In audio land, a dead cat is a kind of windsock or wind shield or wind guard. Yeah, the dead cat terminology is also now often being we internalize it when we're on set because it's a funny way to kind of talk about a piece of audio kit. But because, you know, you're wrapping a dead cat around a microphone. But outside of that, we tend to discuss things in ways that are just a touch less ghastly. You can call them a foam shield, a windshield, a wind guard, a windsock. It's all the same. So it's fine. Again, however we want a Venn diagram the on-set discussion of audio recording equipment. If you need to, you can see me with a full blimp rig in the ABCs of Death, where I was the Q is for Quack in the ABCs of Death, where I played the sound guy while I was the actual sound guy for that 5-minute horror short. So take it to the bank. And then lastly, I feel like this can kind of kick us into the holiday film conversation. Maybe one of the videos I've been most proud of this year, because I'm completely correct. And anyone who would argue with me, you don't got it. I'm sorry. You can have different feelings, but your feelings are incorrect. Is Die Hard is a Christmas movie. Let's put this debate to rest. It took me a little longer to make this than I thought it would. So, actually, let me just kind of show why real quick. I'm going to stream this to there. So I had to do a bunch of this. Oh, come on. No, don't do that. Get rid of this. No, this is so annoying. YouTube has changed how they embed videos. So there's a lot of this where I'm doing a recording of a laptop screen to show my clips for Die Hard. I did a first pass where I just cut in clips. I don't get how movie review channels do this. The second I uploaded that video, it was like instant content ID. Now even though you're talking about very specific moments in the film and you're following all of the rules for commentary and critique, there is no audio from the movie. No, we can't have this. I don't get it. I really don't understand. And this has been the failing like years back in 2008, 2009, when we started Movies You May Have Missed. Even then, we were just getting hammered with copyright strikes and content ID matches, and it jacks the monetization on your channel. So I had the whole video shot and produced, and you're like, I still have to put in these clips. It can't just be me talking to the camera. So I angled a laptop screen and shot video of those clips playing on a laptop screen just to try and get around some of content ID's content matching. And so far, knock on wood, I haven't had my channel ganked for you know, deigning to use small snippets of Die Hard in a video diary talking about the analysis of Die Hard as a Christmas movie. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, because of that, it took me a lot longer. Like, I had to shoot a bunch of laptop clips, whereas normally I just cut from the actual film, from the actual Blu-ray rip that I've got of Die Hard. But anyway, my issues with YouTube notwithstanding, there is no good argument for denying Die Hard Christmas movie status. Die Hard is not just a movie that takes place at Christmas. Die Hard is legit a Christmas movie. So, I mean, I'm sure there are some people in here that maybe disagree. That means you don't understand the movie, or you haven't watched it recently, or you don't understand what Christmas movies are. So first, we would have to define what is a Christmas movie. And if you can define that for me in a way that excludes Die Hard, I mean, I think it's a little easier to make some of these arguments about Lethal Weapon, but I still think there is a core story to Lethal Weapon about family and being adopted and being alone for the holidays. It's about like a rage psycho that kills a bunch of people, but bookended in that film is someone who finds a family to celebrate the holidays with. I still feel that's a Christmas theme. So if there's someone in here, and I don't want everyone else in the chat who obviously is of a, you know, sort of a correct mindset when it comes to Die Hard, what is the definition of a Christmas movie that you can point to that excludes a movie like Die Hard? And if you can do that, then we can have a legit conversation, a real conversation about film and art and these categories that seem to matter to people. Because if your definition of a holiday film is it's got to be like a goofy romance on the Hallmark Channel, well, I disagree. Christmas movies can be anything. They're often sort of schmaltzy. They're often kind of goofy. Some of them are funny. But let's not forget that classic Christmas stories used to be very dark, used to be ghastly. Look at It's a Wonderful Life is like, it starts off with kind of a commentary on someone about to commit suicide because they lost a bunch of money. You know, it's the commerce of this small town is ruined by someone's mistake, and he's about to jump off a bridge. Like, that's how much he's messed up. We could look at a movie or a story like Ebenezer Scrooge, A Christmas Carol, and it's about haunting the crap out of a rich person until he feels like he can be just a teeny bit more generous in his day-to-day life. Apparently, it takes supernatural intervention to convince rich people not to be massive D-bags. You know, that's a Christmas story. It's a ghost story. We have allied Christmas with horror themes. And that's a Christmas movie. So there's no reason why a Christmas film can't be an action adventure. Like, you're incorrect if it's just, well, there are machine guns. You can't have machine guns in a Christmas film. All right. Loki Ted, if Die Hard is a Christmas movie, then so is Lethal Weapon. Nah. Well, no, you're incorrect. I've explained how Lethal Weapon could be a Christmas film. Do you hate family? If you hate family, then Lethal Weapon, I guess, might not be a Christmas film. Boang Bite Home Alone is definitely a Christmas movie. There is a shocking amount of violence in Home Alone. Just because it's a kid, don't let that dissuade you from... And some of it's slapsticky, but some of it really not. I mean, when Home Alone was made, I think the edict was more pain equals more funny. And that is absolutely a Christmas film. Gremlins, phenomenal Christmas film. And just one of the most hilarious, shocking horror monologues. Is it Phoebe Cates talking about the chimney and Santa? Vasicos 8, Juan's feeling for Die Hard are right up there with his hate for side-scrolling after horrors. I unabashedly adore Die Hard. If you watch my video commentary, my analysis of the movie Die Hard, I feel I've taken the analysis of that film deeper than anyone else I've seen speak on Die Hard. And again, I really feel it's Holly McClain's movie, and people have completely dismissed her character, and it's very frustrating how, on the surface, it's the bromance between John and Al. But people continuously lose sight of what the core relationship arc is between John and Holly. And from Alice Bakley, Gremlins is also a Christmas movie, so why not Die Hard?
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
Jim, it doesn't matter what Bruce Willis says. Jim says Bruce Willis says it's not a Christmas movie. That doesn't matter. The filmmakers and the person who wrote the screenplay said there was every effort to incorporate Christmas into the story. So, yeah, the people who made the movie, not just the one person who starred in it, have all said that they wanted to incorporate these themes into an action adventure film. It's a Christmas movie. McCorcoran, it takes place during Christmas, has a heartwarming ending, and an affable, heavyset character. Christmas movie. McCorcoran 3, is Die Hard the most violent Christmas movie of all time? If based on my criteria, you can make a strong argument for Lethal Weapon, and I would say the two probably go head-to-head pretty well. I feel there are themes in Batman Returns that qualify it as a solid holiday Christmas movie. I mean, beyond just Merry Christmas, Alfred. Merry Christmas, Mr. Wayne. The whole subplot with the Penguin, again, it's about loss. It's about not having a family to celebrate the holidays with. It's being sort of rejected by people that should have loved you. There's a little bit of weight to a movie like Batman Returns. And there's a fair amount of gore. You know, there's Penguin eating fish heads. As far as holiday-themed movies go, I don't know. I'd say it's a toss-up. I would say it's a toss-up between Die Hard and Lethal Weapon. So, let's see. ER1980. Yeah, that punch at the end by Holly. Not just the punch at the end. I still feel like the climax of the film depends on Holly and John. It's just brilliant. It's just really wonderful. Nick Fell, now the question is, Nightmare Before Christmas, Halloween, or Christmas film? And Dave Burns has the right answer. ¿Por qué no los dos? It is absolutely both. But because Nightmare Before Christmas, I almost said Nightmare on Elm Street. Nightmare on Elm Street, it's a Christmas film. Nightmare Before Christmas is a Halloween entity who is a fish out of water experiencing Christmas land. I feel it's a stronger watch for Christmas than it is for Halloween. But that's just my opinion. I feel it works for both. McCorcoran, Bruce Willis is clearly waging a war on Christmas. Yeah, if Bruce Willis says his own film is not a Christmas movie, he's dead wrong.
Absolutely. I'll say it to his face. Dear Mr. Bruce Willis, you are incorrect about one of the best movies you've ever made. Someone send that to him in a tweet. Oof. Sam Peckinpah's Santa Psycho is rough. I don't think I've ever seen that. What is that famous old cheesy? Is it Santa Claus? Isn't there some? Oh, I'm gonna have to look this up. Garbage Day. What is that film? Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2. So if you want to get into some holiday horror schlock. And again, now I am not advocating for Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2 to be in your Christmas film collection. But it is a holiday-themed horror film with one of the cheesiest, corniest, funniest lines ever. Garbage Day. Yeah, I see. I don't understand why a holiday film, especially for the themes of Christmas being kind of dark at times, why we can't have Christmas horror. The theme of a Christmas film means that there is some character arc or some lesson learned that's in keeping with a time of self-reflection as we close out the year. And it could be reflection over the year, or it could be reflection over a lifetime. And that, you know, it's nice when maybe a co-theme of that is some kindness offered. But if there's not like a character arc that's built in self-reflection and redemption, then I don't really feel you've leaned into the properties of a Christmas film. So you get into Die Hard, and Al's storyline is actually a story of redemption, where he redeems a past mistake. Again, it's through violence that he does this, but there's a moment of him learning and growing. And for the goofy, affable side character, we're still given a moment that you should feel something by the time you get to the end of that movie. Same thing with John. The entire story of John McClane, he's wrong. He made a huge mistake in his marriage. He was incorrect, and he needs to do something to kind of correct, to redeem himself as a husband. You know, that to me is a holiday theme. How do you rekindle some part of a marriage? It's not a cheesy, corny Hallmark romance where two people are just learning so much about each other and it's all exposition dumps and now we kiss at the end under the mistletoe. That's not the gig. Die Hard doesn't give you that. It's not tacky holiday sweaters and lots of garish lighting. It's a bit of garish lighting, but it's L.A., so you don't get the tacky holiday sweaters. But the core idea is still one of two people rekindling some aspect of their marriage that they thought they had lost. How is that not in keeping with the holidays? You know, if you can't, again, I totally appreciate why some people don't like machine guns in their stories about marriage. But that doesn't deny there are very clear and palpable themes that are perfectly in keeping with the holiday spirit. I don't understand why we couldn't have that in a horror film. I don't understand why we couldn't have that in like a crime drama, a bank heist movie. You know, like there's no reason why we can't fit these ideas into these kinds of pieces. Like you could make a play for putting together like an ensemble crime caper, like an Ocean's 11. And as long as the characters experience some kind of a moment that's in keeping with the holidays, it could be a Christmas theme. It could be a holiday movie. Let's see. Hold on, I'm way behind on the chat. I've got to catch up here. This is great. Chevy Chase kidnaps his boss in Christmas Vacation. Yeah, so isn't there also I'm thinking of National Lampoon's Vacation, like where he holds someone at gunpoint to go ride a roller coaster. That's not in Christmas Vacation. Why can't we bring back Santa Claus who breaks in your home and eats your children? Krampus. From Loki Ted, Batman Returns was dark, not because it was Christmas, but because it is Gotham and Tim Burton. No. Batman Returns is dark. Yes, Batman stories are dark. It's a dark crime drama kind of character. But Batman Returns is dark because we follow the storyline of the Penguin, who was abandoned by his parents, the Cobblepots, on Christmas, where in the glow of a warm holiday home, they take their somewhat disfigured child and put him on a boat and send him down a river. Like, that movie is dark in holiday themes. It's ghastly in a very kind of Christmas way, especially when we compare it to classical literature like Charles Dickens. Dave Burns, which Nightmare on Elm Street are we talking about? Trolls 2, Krampus. From Nick Feld, does setting a movie at Christmas force it to be a Christmas film because there are horror films with none of the themes? See, this is what I mean. On a very surface level, Die Hard is a movie that just takes place at Christmas time, and it's about a dude who runs around a building shooting machine guns. On a technical level, there is every aspect of that movie where the filmmakers are considering the time for the action, from the score to the holiday packing tape to the ho, 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 I have a machine gun to the set destruction as the helicopter crashes and the Christmas trees that are pulled down by set hands. You know, like, on a technical level, there is every consideration. It's not like they just show a palm tree with some lights on it and then we forget that it's Christmas for the rest of the movie. You know, when the bad guys break open the bank and they wish each other a Merry Christmas, you know, spoilers if you haven't seen Die Hard. Every single part of the technical creation is leaning into the time and the setting. But beyond that, there are some very clear character themes that are explored that I think fit into that better. Horror films depend on a completely different set of tropes, but I'm kind of surprised. You know, there are so many really good slow burn psychological thriller ghost stories. And that to me would be sort of the perfect horror genre to return to Christmas. Characters learn things. It's literal, like, these huge metaphors for the skeletons in your closet or the memories that linger with you. Films like The Babadook, you know, I think could make a great, you could make a great holiday themed character redemption arc kind of story, looking back on their life or being weighted down by these memories of old loved ones. There's no reason why that couldn't be holiday fare. And in fact, that's kind of the basis of some of the core mythology surrounding Christmas being used in fictional storytelling. Why I keep pointing to Charles Dickens, but you know, in a very sort of Brothers Grimm style storytelling, you know, we have all these warm fuzzy memories of these like fairy tales. A lot of those fairy tales were a lot meaner and a lot darker than we remember. McCorkran, think of how dark Christmas movies will be when the North Pole melts. Oh, it's already happening. It's not great. Oh, Matt Tyler sharing some other emotes. Thanks, man. And Matt Tyler gifted a sub to Aditya. Much appreciated. Again, thank you for supporting production on this channel. So that's kind of where it got me into just considering, you know, like what are some of our go-to holiday films? And Marie and I were having this conversation a while back, just like some of the movies that we used to watch, you know, like didn't talk about a good holiday pun, the movies we used to watch religiously. You know, like, you know, we used to love putting on Love Actually and kind of watching through Love Actually. But as we get older, the storylines in Love Actually start to fall apart. And what we like about that movie becomes a little bit more narrow and narrow and narrow. And, it's tough, you know. No way. Just in time for my holiday podcasts. It sounds like we've got landscapers out by the window. We haven't had landscapers on a Monday for a really long time. So apologies if this sounds... I don't even have like RTX voice set up on the podcast anymore because they just haven't been here for a long time. Let me drink some water here real quick. That's, you know, you might not even be able to hear it, but it's just super distracting to me. But now that we're not like watching content on TV, like A Christmas Story is kind of back into our holiday movie rotation. We always watch Scrooged. I love the Bill Murray Scrooged. It's 80s funny and witty with just enough little dark. You know, we can't show it to Lex yet because I still think the Ghost of Christmas Future would freak her out. But, you know, ghastly moments and dealing with loss and regret. And it's Bill Murray, I think, at his Ghostbusters finest in kind of a screwball comedy kind of way. But they take the premise of ghosts visiting an obnoxious rich person really seriously. DT knows cracking me up. Love Actually is the one with Infidelity, right? If that's your takeaway, sure. Sure, Love Actually can be the movie that has some infidelity in it. Good job, Aditya. Everyone give him a pat on the back. Dave Byrne saying Christmas Vacation 2. I haven't seen Christmas Vacation 2. Andy, Love Actually is good for watching Bill Nighy singing and then you turn it off. When Marie and I were talking about this, because the cast is phenomenal, like the cast of Love Actually is proper fantastic, but the movie suffers for it being such a smattering of tiny little holiday short stories that are then sort of stitched together, and they try and find these loose common threads where some of the characters know each other. The Bill Nighy story, I think, is the most fun. The rest of them have started becoming a bit more problematic. You know, the age difference between, you know, some of the characters as they are trying to find romance. Excuse me. As they're trying to find romance. The unrequited love storyline just kind of doesn't mean anything. Like, what are we supposed to feel? Who are we rooting for? The little vignettes start kind of chipping away. I still like the little kid and his dad after, you know, his wife passes away. Liam Neeson has... It's the scene with Liam Neeson and Emma Thompson that I just is still like one of the most human moments in the whole film. I'm like, oh, no one's going to want to shag you if you're just crying all the time. And you're like, it's just such a great moment between two friends. And again, two brilliant performers achieving that moment. You know, that kind of stuff, I think, still holds up. But as Marie and I get older, like the romance of that movie just completely doesn't land anymore at all. Ah, 77 gift subs. Merry Christmas, Aditya and Greg. But we've actually been trying to figure out what was it that we just watched? Klaus, the animated movie Klaus. That was pretty good. My daughter absolutely loves the movie Noel with Anna Kendrick. And I think that's going to be kind of in our rotation of fun, cheesy, kid-friendly holiday films. We got to go see Elf at a drive-in. So there was a pop-up drive-in out here, sort of out in the suburbs. Big empty field. And it was kind of sad because the company that put together the drive-in, it's a series of drive-in movies. It used to be just... you would go and sit out on a blanket and they would have food trucks. And that was really fun. It was just like a movie out under the stars kind of a thing. Wrap up in blankets and get, you know, food from a food truck and watch a movie. Well, in the time that we're in right now, you don't want to have a whole bunch of people all clustered together. So they shifted to make it more of a drive-in movie experience. But with our recent numbers climbing, the only way that they could keep the movie series going was to cancel the food truck part of it. So they just strongly encouraged that you support local businesses and you buy some food and you eat it in your car. But the watching a movie in your car is still crazy fun. If you have the opportunity to, if you have the means to, checking out a drive-in right now was just this wonderful little relief. It just felt like this little pocket of normal. And it's something that I hope continues even after like vaccines are out. Because you know, we've got a precocious, rambunctious five-year-old and she does not sit still for anything. And so we're in the safety of our own car. We're not bothering other people if she's kind of bouncing around in the back seat. And we ate like a whole pizza in the car and we had all kinds of snacks. It's okay if like, you know, our popcorn bag is rustling and like candy boxes are rattling and we're sort of enclosed in this little space where other people aren't interrupting our movie watching experience. And it was Elf and it's a movie we've seen before. Even Lex has watched Elf before. So it wasn't like so precious that we paid attention to every moment. But it was really wonderful. It's just like one of the best ways that we've gotten out of the house in a really long time. So we have gone through like Frosty the Snowman and the animated, the original animated How the Grinch Stole Christmas. I haven't tried the Charlie Brown Christmas. I don't know if Lex would like that because if I remember correctly, it's actually kind of mean to Charlie Brown. Like he gets... he just gets picked on a whole bunch. But yeah, our movie watching was a little lighter this year. Because one of the things that we were also doing is Marie and I needed to catch up on a lot of TV. In years past where we've been more on top of our TV and movie viewing, we kind of cordon off like 2 weeks of Christmas to watch a Christmas movie every night. But like, you know, we just wrapped up Mandalorian season two. No spoilers. I did not like Mandalorian season two as much as I liked season one, but it was still pretty good. We finished that last night. Like I maybe only got about 5 hours of sleep because we wanted to get through, no spoilers, with Mandalorian. Again, really good Star Wars storytelling, but I kind of liked how separate the first season of Mandalorian was from the rest of Star Wars lore. And Mandalorian season two is a lot more shout outs and callbacks to other Star Wars properties. I mean, again, if you're a fan of Clone Wars, there are moments that you're really going to like. A fan of the original trilogy, there are going to be moments you really like. But I really dug that the first season helped Star Wars feel much larger than just Skywalkers and Clone Wars. And season two kind of brought it back into the core Star Wars storytelling that I think has gotten kind of insular. It's gotten kind of sort of circular. And I want more properties that take Star Wars off in more interesting directions. As just a general plea to anyone who might be making another Star Wars property, could you maybe find some other planets than Tatooine? Do we ever need to go back to Tatooine ever again? I guess we will because we know that Boba Fett is going to be the star of a spinoff and we know that there's going to be an Obi-Wan Kenobi show. So I guess we're just going to have a lot more Tatooine. But really, this is a universe and this universe needs to be larger than that one planet. You remember that one planet that they found Luke on, right? Right? We could let's go back to that planet because you remember that. You liked Luke. Oh, remember? He came from Tatooine. You remember the word Tatooine? We can say Tatooine a whole bunch. Wow. So anyway, Dave Burns, I don't think we finished housekeeping yet. I love it. So yeah, it's good times. This entire podcast is just going to be all housekeeping and talking about other movies and TV shows. Not particularly holiday themed either, although there are some good feels in Mandalorian. I wouldn't put it up there as Christmas media. The other show that we were kind of racing to finish up, we were way behind. We needed to make it through The Boys, season two also. And again, man, that was a brutal watch. It was really, The Boys is like moved from sort of a comedic cynicism in the first season to just like
outright hard sardonic satire in the second season. I mean, it is just darkly cynical getting through superhero content like that. And it kind of throws a thumb in the eye of all of the things that I kind of feel like, less so with Marvel, a bit more with DC, where DC is learning the wrong lessons from their successes. Oh, these Batman movies that Christopher Nolan made were really good and they did really well at the box office. Let's make all of our movies dark and gritty and edgy now. And there have been a few YouTube videos that I've been watching, but I kind of agree with the sentiment. Like, a medium needs to evolve. Comics need to be accessible. You can't spend, where are we? Like 60 years? No, it's like 80 years with a character like Superman, right? Superman came about near World War II. Is that the golden age of comics? 70 years, 80 years, somewhere in there. Anyway, this is a serialized character that has always been sort of, if at least family friendly, if not designed for kids. And then just because there are a bunch of angry 40-year-old men on the internet, now everything is near rated R levels of violence from an authoritarian character version of Superman who doesn't listen to anyone, is morose and brooding and dark and edgy. And like, that's not Superman. That is the Superman that we see in the live action DC films is just a step removed from Homelander. I mean, that's how biting the sort of the satire is. That's how cynical The Boys is when we look at what's happened with these classic comic characters. And just all of the individuals responsible for those storylines now all kind of walking away from their own creations, you know, like Alan Moore. He starts talking about the regret of making certain types of comic storylines and how some of his fans just not getting it. And then that kind of creates this like threshold of, well, now we've got to push even edgier. Now we got to push even darker. Now we got to go even grittier. And he's like, man, I wouldn't have done that if I'd known this was going to be the outcome of my creation. I don't want to be the guy responsible for making comics, you know, dark edgelord for adults. You know, that's not what I was trying to accomplish. It's kind of funny. We do this in movies a lot. A director has this idea of shocking an audience. I can't remember his name now, but the man who directed Funny Games, the movie Funny Games was supposed to be this this exploration of cinema violence that was supposed to be so insidious that it was going to make the audience sort of self-reflect on what it is that they're looking for in a movie. You know, it was going to make you consider, why is it that you go to watch depictions of violence in cinema? And maybe it had that effect on some people, but now when you watch Funny Games, it has been eclipsed by PG-13 depictions of violence moving beyond. And we kind of keep falling for this, like Paul Verhoeven movies, like RoboCop. RoboCop was supposed to be, again, an over-the-top satirical depiction of hyperviolence in cinema. And now it's kind of tame, you know, like we just used that as the new watermark and, oh, well, we can go even further from there. So again, getting back to comics, like she's not quite ready for it yet, but I want my daughter's first experiences with Batman to be the animated series. Brilliant storytelling, gorgeous art direction, a clear line from Batman the Animated Series to Batman Beyond. Then we can go through the Justice Leagues. Those are the versions of the characters that I want her to consume first. And then from there, when she can kind of read and choose, and if she decides to start picking up comics, there are some classic comic storylines that I would love for her to check out. I'm going to hold the cynicism, you know, the Watchmen and the Dark Knight Returns and all that stuff until she's quite a bit older, because I want her to love these characters. I want her to enjoy these characters. And it's what I hope we don't fall for in Star Wars. It's what I hope we can crawl out of. I'd love to see a Superman movie with Henry Cavill. Because again, it's not on the actors. It's on the writers and the producers not learning the right lessons. A Batman storyline can be dark. He should be hunting down serial killers. A Batman movie in the vein of Seven, totally appropriate. But a Superman film should be about hope and light and being a shield. You know, the moment where Wonder Woman climbs out of the trench in World War I was the best Superman moment we never got in the Superman films. They nailed it with Wonder Woman. We never got that with Superman. So that's what I want my daughter to know. I mean, if it's the Christopher Reeves films, cornball? Absolutely. But bright and hopeful, and Superman is a shield for those that are weaker than him. Superman should lose every fight against the bad guy if it means he can protect an innocent bystander. That's Superman. Like, that's the only Superman that makes any sense to me. I want to see a Flash movie where it's fun and bright and electric. I want a Flash movie that's kind of in the vein of Shazam. Like, Shazam, I think, is the closest we've gotten in DC land to kind of nailing the kid spirit of some of this commentary. Hold on, I gotta do something here real quick. All right. Aditya Anil, the animated Batman cartoon Not Beyond was actually pretty heavy in themes for a kid show. Like, I still enjoy it today. And so I think Batman the Animated Series is a very good example of a show that's appropriate for kids, but it's not a kid's show. Really splitting hairs here. What's a Christmas movie? Is it a movie that takes place at Christmas, or is it a movie that is a Christmas movie? And same thing. Batman the Animated Series is a show that transcends age demographics. It's good for grown-ups. It's good for kids. It's appropriate for children. Even through Mask of the Phantasm. Again, I'm going to have to wait a bit before we get to Mask of the Phantasm, but that's still one of the best Batman movies. And Kevin Conroy, just great Batman voice. Love it. I mean, it's just burned into my brain. It's like him. Clancy Brown is Lex Luthor. Absolutely some of my favorite. Mark Hamill is the Joker. My favorite depictions of these characters. And, like, you know, they're not live action. But yeah, like, even for some of that heavy stuff, you know, kids can handle heavy. It's just that I want it to be an appropriate depiction of those characters and kind of geared in a way where it's not disturbing to tackle some of those themes. And I feel like Batman the Animated Series is still one of the absolute most perfect confluences of dark storytelling, some of these dark themes or heavier themes, with a character who has suffered tragedy and loss in a very sort of Greek kind of way, but it's created in a way that it's wholly accessible to the whole family. You know, my wife likes that, those shows. I love those shows. When Lex is just a little bit older, we're going to chew through that entire lineup. And just how much media, because there's so much to watch with those DC animated series. We'll have plenty to binge when Lex gets a little older. But, you know, she's already started kind of getting into some of Dad's geekery. Like, Lex and I, we got a Chromecast for the TV that we keep in the bedroom. I don't love having a TV in the bedroom, but, you know, it's kind of nice when we want to just be in different rooms now. Like, my wife's working in the living room. I can take Lex into our room. We can watch something together. I was testing out Plex on the Chromecast in our bedroom. And, you know, I have a wonderful Blu-ray rip. I bought The Last Starfighter on Blu-ray, ripped it to very high quality, and that's kind of one of my test films. It's that or Galaxy Quest. So I'm firing up The Last Starfighter, and Lex walks in. And I kind of have one of these, you know, sort of hijinky dad moments, like, well, the alien blob beta unit, that kind of freaked me out when I was a kid. And the scene of the spy getting tortured by a laser drilling through his brain, that kind of freaked me out when I was a kid. But the rest of the film, oh, and then also the first time we see Centauri with his face off. I'm gonna take his face off. That kind of wigged me out when I was a kid. Lex is 5. Let's see how she does. And she hung with me that whole movie. She was asking a bunch of questions because, like, why don't they have phones? Like, wait a minute, if they need to talk to Alex, why don't they just call him on his phone? Well, they didn't have pocket computers back then. You know, their examples of really futuristic technology look very quaint by today's standards. But Lex hung with me for The Last Starfighter. I was very impressed with her patience with that movie. And then after that, a couple nights after that, we watched Bumblebee together. And I think she really liked Bumblebee because she knows that I love Transformers. And it's a story about a girl and her robot, you know? So she very, very quickly identified with the girl who wants to fix cars just like her dad. And then she gets her own pet robot. And then they all go and fight the evil robots. Like, she was all for it. Yeah. We had a fun twofer there. But, you know, the fact that Lex is starting to handle some stuff like that, I feel like we're getting really close. Like, maybe by her next birthday, we'll really in earnest start chewing through the DC animated stuff. Because those are the versions of the characters that I want her to know. And then you can say, like, well, this stuff's made more for grown-ups, so we can kind of push the boundaries on dark, edgy stuff there. This is the stuff that, you know, like, it was classic, so it's even more cornball, like the original Spider-Man cartoons. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, can't sing more or I'll get a copyright strike. You know, we can at least kind of show her that over time, this stuff is supposed to be of its time. As she gets older, she'll find some other version of Superman that she'll probably like better, you know? But this is what mommy and daddy like. So for now, you got to watch it too. Yeah, from Jim, comics need to be written for 13-year-olds again. And I kind of feel like it's the same thing I was just talking about with Star Wars. Not just that we need to write comics for 13-year-olds, but we need to give them things that are for them. You know, like when I was growing up, X-Men was very different than the X-Men that my dad read. My dad was all about X-Men and Iron Man. Those were his jams. And so that kind of came to us. And my brother and I, we loved X-Men. We loved Iron Man. You know, I kind of veered more into Batman and Spider-Man territory. But, like, you know, we got this from our dad. But when I look at, you know, the comics that he would show me from the X-Men, and then I would look at the comics that I loved from the X-Men, like, very, very different. And I kind of feel like right now comics are stuck in this, we need to appease the fans loop. And that is shrinking the fan base of this media. And instead, we should kind of be going off and creating new experiences, new content, new characters. Instead, we kind of just soft reboot every couple of years. And here's what Wolverine's all about now. But it's still the same Wolverine. And you're still going to get the same fight. Oh, no, it's Sabretooth. Oh, they're going to fight. All that kind of happens is like a Dragon Ball Z power ramp, right? You know, Wolverine, when I was into 90s cartoons, could be hurt and would require time to heal. He healed faster than an average person, but he couldn't be completely incinerated and regrow from his skeleton in a matter of minutes. Like, he couldn't, you know, I have a huge chunk of him blown away and then watch it all just reform in real time. I don't know if you remember, like, the Fox 90s cartoon, like, after one of his first altercations with Sabretooth and he's hurt pretty bad, that scene of him on the bed, you know, like, kind of stroking the picture frame with Jean Grey in the picture frame, he's bandaged up. Like, he needed time to heal. That's the Wolverine I grew up with, not the completely invulnerable magic Wolverine that we see in movies today. So again, like, if we just keep power cycling, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't make these stories better. It's not like, whoa, this is so much more extreme because Wolverine got blown up by an atom bomb and there was like just one tiny piece of his flesh left and it reformed all of Wolverine again. Whoa. Like, that's lame. I mean, like, there's no danger for a character like that. So what's the point of even trying to tell stories with him?
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
I started Tech Potato with a vision. I'd already been covering processes and technology for 10 years as senior editor for Inantech, but only through the written word. With today's media so diverse, I chose to one-up my vision and move to video and explain the nuance of complex topics. Hi, my name's Ian Cutress, and I'm Chief Spud at Tech Potato. The goal at Tech Potato is to have fun, to talk about areas of the technology industry that aren't always covered. Sometimes there are non-obvious aspects to a topic which doesn't always come across in written media, and that's where I strike. The channel is also there to shine a light into the areas that most end users don't even know exist. There's also a tongue-in-cheek joke. Processors are called chips, and just like a bag of chips, I like to get my teeth into these things, hence Tech Potato. The thumbnails are stupid, but the content is real. If you're interested about how things in this technology industry work, or for reports on behind-the-scenes events, plus some classic British humour, then head on over. You'll be welcome with open arms.
Well, and yeah, Warhead, this is exactly the thing that I appreciate. DC animated movies and shows usually are more based in storylines, hence more enjoyable. What I love is that when you watch Justice League and Justice League Unlimited, it feels like they took these core storylines, but then they found new avenues to explore with those characters. You still get Darkseid, you still get, you know, Brainiac. There's all of the same trappings, but they feel fresh. And they feel like some new takes on some of those stories and some of those characters. It's more exciting for me. It's more fun kind of going off in that direction as a side venture of the comics that I love. The shows do something fresh with those characters. Dave Burns, PDAs were real bad when the last Starfighter came out. Were there? Hold on. When did the last Starfighter come out? Because it was the 80s, right? I don't think we even had the... 1984. So we were still talking about Apple Macintosh computers and the Super Bowl ad that looked like it came out of a 1984 film. I don't think we even had Newton yet. So, no. Yeah, PDAs would have been real bad in 1984. Raymondit, I don't believe Last Starfighter is streaming anywhere. Hold on, let me see. No, it's only for renting. You can rent it on a bunch of different platforms, but I don't think you can stream it like on Netflix or anything. Again, there are so many of those movies now where I've just given up and I've started buying the Blu-ray. Trading Places. You know, we were talking about unconventional holiday films. I just put in an order because it used to be on Netflix and then it was removed from the Netflix catalog, or maybe it was Amazon. Anyway, it was on one of the streaming services. I watched it a bunch. Like, it was just good background movie fodder. I love that movie. It's the perfect, double feature, Trading Places and Coming to America. Brilliant 80s comedies. So, you know, like, again, like, I'm not going to buy it on another streaming platform. I'm just tired of, like, you know, oh, well, I can own an HD copy of it on Google or on Amazon. And so, no, I'm just going to buy the Blu-ray, do a really high quality rip of the Blu-ray, and then it lives on my NAS and I can control exactly how, when, where, and why I want to watch that movie. I'm way behind on the chat, so I'm just saying Vazicost is telling me to check my posture and Adich is telling me to stretch. This is a little while back. Do that. Aditya Anil, Bumblebee is such a cute movie. They finally gave Bee something resembling a personality. Not only is it fun, the very beginning, I believe he's voiced by Roger Craig Smith, who was someone I worked a lot with when I was still doing voice casting. So that was a nice little perk. It's also chock full of a bunch of really cute shout outs. You know, she joins a group of teens at like this cliffside party, and one of the hot guys goes jumping off into the water, and the peer pressure is, well, she used to be a championship diver, so maybe she should jump off the cliff too. And Bumblebee starts playing You Got the Touch from the 1980s animated Transformers movie. And that's like his way to try and push her to go and have fun with a bunch of teen kids. The last scene is as Bumblebee's driving off as a Camaro. He drives by a red semi with a gray trailer. You know, just so many cute little moments that are nerdcore animated Transformer fan shout outs. It's really, really cute. From Jim, Umbrella Academy works because no one has smartphones. It's true. Oh, Umbrella Academy. That's the one I couldn't remember. There was another season two we had to get through. I completely slipped on Umbrella Academy, so I got to go and check that one out. Aditya Anil, Wolverine goes Super Saiyan and defeats Superman while Joker laughs from the Starship Enterprise with Han Solo as his prisoner. I mean, at some point, especially if Disney has continued to allow Disney to buy up every other property, at some point that could happen. If just Disney becomes our singular corporate overlord, then yeah. And Nick Fell, power creep is the real enemy of superheroes. I like some drama. I like a Superman who is more powerful than anyone else, but is not like omnipotently, omnipresently, omnipowerful. Again, there needs to be some drama or some stakes. There needs to be some weakness, something. You know, again, that's why, again, like a more satirical look, like a One Punch Man, is kind of fun and funny for examining the condition of power creep superhero storytelling. From Jim, the worst trend in comics is the variant covers for everything. It's like the snake eating its own tail. And being a 90s kid for comics, I totally resemble that, where it was like, I've got to collect every single variant issue of this awesome comic, and none of them are worth anything. I've got a box. You know, I actually did a purge. It's like, well, I've got one issue of this, and I want to keep this one issue, but I don't need the six other covers. So I'm just going to send these to I took a box of them. Took a box of them to a comic shop in Burbank, and they were like, I can't give you any money for this. None of it's worth anything. It's like, I literally just don't want to throw them away. And the guy behind the counter goes, I get it. Yeah, I'll take them. And it was like, I'm not even asking for money. I just don't want them to end up in a landfill as just garbage. But they're not really worth much more than garbage. It was just this horrible, nerdy interaction between two defeated, you know, 90s kids comic book fans. And it made me so sad. But I was just so happy to not, like, he probably just took them off of me and then, like, waited till I left and then just dumped them in a bin. I should have gone back to check. Like, hey, do you still have that number 3 with the foil? I actually didn't mean to give you that. Can I buy it back off of you? And then watch him go, actually, I totally sold that comic. Wouldn't you know? I'm sure he threw him away. Now that I say this out loud, he probably just wanted me out of his store. Across the podcast with Sam and Matt. He's joining the chat. Everyone say, hey, Sam. Really great to see you in here, too. Yeah, Dave Burns, too. It would be great if these were archived and open to the public like old pulp magazines. Or like, have any of you ever gone through Internet Archive has like the entire run of Nintendo Power? Has anyone gone through and just read some old issues? It is so hyper nostalgic. And I remember how much I loved chewing through those old magazines. Again, you want to see me get all like weepy and emotional and self-reflective. And yeah, that was one that took me back. Yeah, so Sam used to be subbed to Nintendo Power. I think Dave Burns is having kind of a brain moment here. But yeah, I miss that feeling, you know? you knew it was coming. You didn't know exactly when. Maybe your neighbor got their issue ahead of you, show up in like a cheap plastic wrapper, this new magazine. I was getting Wizard for a while. I was getting Nintendo Power for a while. When I was younger, it was like zoo books. I'd get like animal magazines. Every week would be a different animal. I kind of miss that feel. You know, the digital equivalents of that kind of stuff just don't have the same vibe for me, because I was just programmed by like magazines and catalogs and toy catalogs and, you know, a piece of paper, you know, crappy printing, mediocre journalism and writing. But man, it was for me. And it was really good times. Aditya, no. Okay, I'm so blind to the point where I can't begin to immediately imagine a situation of building an anime without power creep. I mean, anime has kind of taken on that. I mean, they kind of own power creep. But I think it works better in kind of like in films than in serial content, you know, in the shows. Because the shows need to continuously create drama and raise the stakes. So you end up with this, like, very quickly, they're god tier powerful entities that could destroy the universe. And I totally understand that. Or it's this new alien is going to fight us. I better build a better mech. You know, Iron Man is the American depiction of power creep, where, you know, every Iron Man story kind of depends on, I'm going to fight this bad guy. Oh no, this bad guy just laid me out. Better build a better suit of armor. Now I'm going to take him down. And when you get through the Extremis storyline, you're like, okay, well, we can kind of stop doing that now, right? We can do something different with Iron Man. Nope. Nope. Iron Man stays in that box. You shut up. But again, it's why I love, you know, sort of some of the like classic anime cinema. Like a Vampire Hunter D, you know, that just, you know, still kind of puts me on edge, because I watched that when I was way too young. Or Akira, or, you know, any Ghost in the Shell, those classic films. You get that in that self-contained storyline. And maybe there are sequels where they go off and they do other things and the characters become more powerful, but that one contained story doesn't suffer from ridiculous power creep expectations. Yeah, my tech review. It was included with the NES and included the complete map of Zelda and Super Mario 2 in the front. Good times. Dave Burns 2. I would watch the crap. David says we need a Ryan Johnson Iron Man. I would love to see his take, Ryan Johnson's take on a very traditional superhero story like that. I'm watching Mandalorian and I keep coming back to these ideas. Like, I want Star Wars to be bigger. I want it to feel bigger. And J.J. Abrams style storytelling makes a galaxy feel so small. You know, it happened in Star Trek. Oh, let's watch Vulcan get destroyed from another planet. How? It's not even a good metaphor for what Spock might be feeling. No, I can literally just look up in the night sky and look, Vulcan is falling apart. And I warp drive and I go directly into this fight. And I don't, I don't stop before I end up in this battle. I just end up right in the middle of it. And oh, red alert. The galaxy of Star Trek through J.J. Abrams' lens feels about this big. It feels about as big as, like, Southern California, you know, like, oh, we could see over there that something just blew up. Yeah, but you're in space. Oh, no, no. It's such a big explosion. You can see it with the naked eye in space. Cool. But the same thing kind of happened to Star Wars. So, you know, as much as, you know, was it Episode 8? I can't remember the names of these movies anymore. Was it the last Jedi? Anyway, as much as Rian Johnson gets hated on for a movie that doesn't really work, especially as the middle installment of a trilogy, it definitely doesn't succeed at being a good Star Wars movie. But it is the most impressive deconstruction of Star Wars tropes I've ever seen. And it set the stage for what could have been an incredible new path for Star Wars. You know, we killed the big, bad, evil guy, Snoke. Didn't matter. Luke throws the lightsaber, and I could have kissed Rian Johnson on the mouth for not having excessively unnecessary, flippy, choreographed lightsaber battles. Like, I'm over 20 minutes of jumping from tiny rocks over lava pits, magically levitating over obstacles for the flippiest, bounciest. What I want is a lightsaber battle like a Kurosawa film. If you're really a Jedi master, then your fight should come down to like two slashes, and then the master stands and the less good master falls. I have yet to see that in a Star Wars film. I've seen that exact showdown happen in a terrible Predator movie. I haven't seen it happen yet in Star Wars, and I want that moment, and no one's going to give it to me, and it really pisses me off. You could even like make it into some other metaphor. What is that Jet Li movie with Donnie Yen where they imagine their entire fight, and then the actual physical altercation comes down to one exchange? What is that movie? I can't remember what the name of that movie is. But you could even do something like that in Star Wars. You need to give the fans the flippy BS, overly choreographed movement. Great. Do that. But then really take it down. If these are masters at their craft, it's the one exchange. It's the only exchange that kind of matters. Yeah, exactly. So Loki Ted, it sounds like the Guy Ritchie Sherlock films, especially when Sherlock is fighting Moriarty, and they're both really good at imagining what the outcome of their altercation is going to be. And that before they even fight, Sherlock realizes, like, I can't win this fight. Yes, absolutely. I love that kind of smarter character consideration. You still gave the audience some of the action, but when it really comes down to two people who are supposed to be like preternaturally good at what they do, I don't know if I use that word right. Yes, that's the kind of experience or content that I really, really would like to see. And we've never gotten that in Star Wars. Dave Burns, I do not think the fans need that flippy stuff in Star Wars. Lightsaber battles in the original trilogy were pretty low key. I mean, like, I agree because I grew up with those films and I understand the limitations of the filmmaking craft, and I appreciate what the movies actually accomplished. You've got Sir Alec Guinness with a laser sword. You weren't going to get, Jackie Chan level prop work. But it's often one of those things that you see, you know, like, especially when people go back to defend the prequels, the Star Wars prequels, like, well, the lightsaber battles are just so much better. Like, cool. But they also feel so hollow, you know, they feel so mechanical, and there isn't a lot of drama in them. Then you get to the sequels and it's just a bunch of people that are, again, inconsistently superpowered. Sometimes Jedi and Sith are Superman level telekinetically powerful individuals, and sometimes they can barely put their pants on in the morning. It's all just plot holes that need to be filled with magic space force, and it's not consistent, you know. Again, too many moments where it's just like, well, Darth Vader in the past could like destroy Star Destroyers like with his mind, and now Star Wars in the original trilogy is like, it's kind of a novelty when he like force chokes someone a little bit. Like, yeah, you want to talk about anime style power creep, you know, I yell no and every piece of machinery around me just crumbles from the weight of my force power. And, you know, I wipe out all of those rebels in Rogue One. Anyway. And now in A New Hope, I kind of like choked that one guy. Ooh. Yeah, so Dave Burns, there are no stakes in those other lightsaber battles, and I completely agree. Or at least none of that's been communicated, and you don't feel like there's any weight behind why they're fighting. It's just, well, we need an action beat, so whip out the laser swords. But I would have loved to have seen the final showdown in episode 3 between Obi-Wan and Anakin be Kurosawa style. All build up, all tension, slow motion, close-ups on eyes, flick of the wrist, a heel that digs into the dirt just a bit. Instead of, I have the high ground, don't try and jump over me, or I will cut at your legs. Vazikos, hero from 2004, Jet Li versus Donnie Yen. You want to see some clever filmmaking where they still give you the entire fight sequence, but the two characters going head to head, the actual altercation is boiled down to just a very brief moment. That is such a smart scene for showing masters of martial arts. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I need to go and buy that movie now. I've bought way too many movies over the last couple weeks. DTNNL, Ben Kenobi versus Vader in their first confrontation in A New Hope is, in my opinion, the best fight. Every blow has a purpose. And again, I kind of feel like if the Jedi are these sort of loosely powerful, telekinetic, magical wizards of space, like, they need to be vulnerable. They can't be like the absolute best martial artists and the best telekinetics and telepathic and have laser beams that shoot out of their fingertips and also be omnipresent and be able to communicate telepathically. And like, again, you just keep doing too much without defining what the flow is. So you can never really put them in any jeopardy. Ben Kenobi versus dude in scary, Halloween costume with laser swords feels super vulnerable because he's an old man. We don't know how effective he might be as a fighter. He's probably not going to make it out of this alive. That's great. That feels scary, and it feels like there's danger, and we know that the stakes are pretty high. The one man who's here to try and protect Luke might get offed by this dude who's breathing like a cheap refrigerator. Awesome. By the time you get to, like, the sequels, hoof, oh man. My tech reviews, the Ip Man series with Donnie Yen are a lot of fun. Even Ip Man 4, which is, again, it's just, like, fantasy fan fiction for Ip Man. There's nothing based in any kind of historical accuracy for Ip Man 4. It's still a silly, fun martial arts extravaganza. But yeah, the first Ip Man is still my favorite. I can put that movie on at any time and just like, I'm gonna watch. This is great. LFA Reviews! Jumping in with the tier one, subscribed for 17 months, man. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for jumping in, just saying hey, supporting the channel. I really dig the chatter, the commentary. And everyone needs to go and catch. Jeff has been up pulling some late nights, digging into the AirPods Max. And I'm not jumping on the first wave of AirPods Max reviews. So if you want good commentary from someone who actually knows what they're talking about with headphones, I would highly recommend you check out what Jeff has to say about them. So, what he has to say, I trust more than many other tech influencers in the space. From Loki Ted, my favorite lightsaber scene is episode 1, Darth Maul versus Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, although the Deus Ex at the end was BS. Where was the high ground there? Well, that's just it. No one taught Darth Maul about the high ground. You know, like Obi-Wan was taught about the high ground. So he knew about the high. Darth Maul was never taught about the high ground. So there you go. And Nick Fell, and I think this is a good point, but again, I think it kind of shows that we've lost sight of what made Star Wars storytelling so interesting. So Nick says, was there a point in the entire original trilogy that Vader had a real fight? In episode 4, Kenobi lets him win. In episode 5, he's fighting his son that he hopes to tempt to the dark side. And in episode 6, he doesn't actually fight Luke, if I recall. He doesn't actually fight Luke because he's, again, trying to draw Luke to the dark side. So he's trying to scare him, make him feel his anger and his fear. And the Emperor is right there. So the closest thing I think we get to legit Vader action in the entire trilogy is when he takes out Palpatine. That's it. You know, Palpatine's shooting off the Force lightning. He's hurting his son Luke. Vader finally has his realization. In my version of Star Wars, he doesn't yell, "No!" Because that's dumb. That was a stupid thing to add to Return of the Jedi. Picks up the Emperor. He's getting all shocked. You see a skeleton a bunch of times, and he throws him over the side where the Emperor explodes into blue mist. That's the, I think, the most legit Vader action moment in all three movies. And like Nick is saying, the rest of them, he's just kind of toying with people, or he's really going up against Obi-Wan, but Obi-Wan needs to prove a point and become one with the Force. You know, like the rest of this, like we've built up the mythology and the vision of Vader as this ultimate Sith badass. Oh my gosh, he's so badass. And now it's like we have to have these Star Wars badassery moments, but they don't mean anything. It's what I loved about the season one of Mandalorian is a dude who's just good at his job. He has plenty of awesome moments, but nothing feels so ridiculously OP, over the top. You know, I'm going to telekinetically crush everything in this room with my mind because I'm just so angry. The dark side. No good. No good at all. Oh, we got a good conversation going on about some audio gear. I'll let you guys kind of keep talking about that. LFA reviews Rogue One. Rogue One is probably the scariest moment with Vader that I think we see on screen. So that's kind of cool. I mean, it at least kind of plays into the image of Vader as a very terrifying force in this universe. But again, I kind of feel like we've blown up Vader to these ridiculous sort of expectations. And instead we should be looking at, you know, a very dark, pained individual, both physically and emotionally. And the redemption story of Vader in the original trilogy is what's important. And we kind of lose sight of that when we need to make Vader this all-powerful, magical badass. Oh, and yeah, the whole movie leading up to that point was the win for me. Again, as a contained story, and there's not anything else you can do with those characters, I thought Rogue One worked. I think it fits into this Star Wars storytelling. I just want us to move beyond. I'd love something in Star Wars that doesn't immediately, like, dump a Skywalker in our lap. Or, hey, remember Tatooine? I remember Tatooine. You want to see a laser sword? Anything else. It's a huge universe. Do anything else. And Scrappy Coco, that's why I love Mandalorian. He says, Mando was just straight gangster, man a few words, and his action spoke for itself. Mando is like the best Western we've had in so long. It is so solid. Again, you know, a mysterious stranger rolls into town and he's quick with the gun on his hip. Some Breaking Bad references there, as we can make the loose tie-in of the Empire also fronting Los Pollos Hermanos. I don't know, I mean, we got a good 15 minutes here before we hit that 2-hour mark. I did have a bunch of stories, you know, let me just rapid fire these. Some stuff to kind of keep an eye out for as we kind of close out what this podcast used to represent. Ars Technica has a story about banning rental fees for customer-owned routers. Qualcomm and Google are announcing a collaboration to push Android operating system updates to 4 years. That's going to be starting next year. So if you bought a phone this year, you're a sucker. The Pixel 5 is unlocked. Pixel 5 unlocked, sold out, but it's not gone everywhere. Coming by way of Android headlines. Microsoft might be working on its own chip for a future server and Surface PCs. Facebook is trying to make a play against Apple, saying that they support small businesses when really they're just protecting their revenue stream from leaking all of your private data. And Google will officially support installing Chrome OS on old computers they bought Neverware, which has an installer that helps you convert old PCs to Chromebooks. So some interesting stuff to kind of tackle in there. Someone was mentioning early on, I mean, we were talking about Pixel 5, you know, just kind of taking this podcast back to some tech to close out the show. I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of preaching to the choir here. Those of you who have been in my chats and watching my podcasts or listening to my podcasts, I feel like we're kind of on the same page. I feel like phones like the Pixel 5. Excuse me. Google releases a Pixel 5. They've got some very clear compromises that they're working on. The Pixel 5 is not the same kind of phone that the Pixel 4 was. But we arrive at a price performance value that I think fits with where it's priced in the market. It achieves what I think someone who would be interested in that phone would want to achieve. So tech reviewers get their hands on it and like, oh, well, it doesn't have the bestest processor. And it doesn't have this one other feature that another phone has. So it's not good enough for the monies. Who would buy this phone if it doesn't have the bestest processor? No one should buy it. And they're continuously wrong. Like, how often are we going to keep playing this game? You can pan a phone like the Pixel 5, you're kind of just wrong. So Google probably had very, I bet you their initial run of the Pixel 5 was very small, especially after the Pixel 4 did not sell as well as I'm sure Google had hoped, and that the Pixel 4a sold pretty well considering the price point. I bet you Google's expectations for the Pixel 5 were very small. So it's encouraging that they sold out of that initial run of the Pixel 5. That is good news. That means they're doing something right and that enough consumers are looking at these options and saying like, yeah, actually that phone works for me. My dad is still waffling back and forth. I think he's kind of looking at the Pixel 5 and it's a smaller phone and it's got a big battery and it's got 5G, but then he's looking at the 4A and it's cheaper and it has a headphone jack. I think he's kind of proper torn. I don't know which way he's going to go, but I think right now he's leaning towards the 4A. Like, he's a little less concerned with 5G and he kind of doesn't want to give up on the few times he might need to use a headphone jack. So I think he might go 4A. But Marie's on the Pixel 4a 5G, and so far it seems like it's been pretty positive. So the Pixel 5, you want a streamlined Google Android phone that you know is going to get good software updates, that's going to get good software support. It's going to get new features added. It's not just bug fixes and security patches. Yeah, it's a little bit more expensive, but it's got all of the other trappings of an expensive premium phone. Big battery, wireless and reverse wireless charging, higher refresh rate display, a great camera. What are you missing? You're not missing anything. So again, how often are we going to keep playing this game where tech influencers are just flat out wrong? Like objectively wrong. They were incorrect. So, Bazico say, wait a minute, he did not digress once during the rapid fire. Who is this guy? I just listed off all the headlines that I was gonna talk about. Simon says, Hypno, Pixel 5 isn't even the 855. Even Betty White wouldn't use it. Because again, I mean, like, where do I have it? I've got it over here. You know, I've got my Pixel 5, Snapdragon 765. This is a great daily driver phone. And then I've got my Surface Duo. The horsepower on the 855 is still phenomenal. So I had to poke in. There were a series of like benchmarks, you know, like everyone is leaking the Galaxy S21 like crazy. And Qualcomm put out some of their early benchmarks for the Snapdragon 888, their next-gen SoC. And there, someone shared it on our Apple. Was it our Apple or our iPhone? I can't remember. Anyway, I'm just like, oh my gosh, look at this. Qualcomm's newest chipset can't even catch up to the A14. It's just a runaway victory for Apple. And again, it's all the comments in there. Like, Apple's like two generations ahead of anything you can get on Android. And so I like, all right, I'll play this game. Let's do it. You know, when you compare actual real world apps, none of these advantages from synthetic benchmarks materialize in any way. You can show me a 30%, you know, processing power win for an A13, and I can show you Snapdragon 855 phones and that easily hang with, if not beat, iPhone 11s. Like, this is not hard. When you look at specific applications, there are some wins and some losses, but SoC to SoC, there is no like win. But as we get into the next year, one of the things I'm excited about is more efficiency, battery life, and radio management. That is not sexy. I cannot show you big Geekbench numbers for those types of smartphone uses. But what do we know about the Snapdragon 865? The weakest aspect of Android phones this year was removing the radio and modem from the SoC, from the actual chip, and making it a separate component. They forced manufacturers to buy the SoC and the modem as a package, as two separate pieces. And LTE performance was, if a lateral move, maybe even worse performing than LTE performance last year, in 2019. That was a step down. It's also way worse for battery life. It is less efficient than if all of that hardware is all stapled together on one SoC. So that, to me, is actually one of the most exciting aspects of the 888. I was expecting Qualcomm to milk another year out of separate modems and radios. But instead, they're quickly reversing course on this two-component strategy. So the 888, if you run it in terms of performance more like the 865, we're seeing like 20% power management improvements over the 865. The 865 is gross overkill for processing power over what most people need to do on their phones. I am happy staying at the level of like an 855 or an 865, but getting an immediate like 20% bump in battery and some significant improvements. I'm hoping we see some significant improvements to LTE 5G performance and power management. And that those are all things that Apple won't get until the end of next year. When you buy your iPhone 12, you're getting the hardware for the next couple of years that we're going to be giving up on in the Android space. So in 2021, Androids will probably have materially larger batteries with better power management and better radio management. And so I'm listing all this stuff out in this thread. And of course, it's our Apple. So the only replies I get are like, oh, look at all of this work that someone had to do to justify. Which is funny coming from our Apple people. But like, you know, it's maybe the most upvoted comment I've ever had on our Apple, where it got like 15 upvotes. But I am, you know, increasingly excited to talk about that stuff. You know, when I talk about the Pixel 5 and I'm showing it to people who might be interested in a smaller phone, it is so refreshing being able to say, hey, this is a little phone that has incredible battery life. I mean, it really is stonking good battery life. And especially if you're using it in a more communicator fashion, you know, brief interactions and quick replies and social media and kind of taking a couple snapshots with the camera, but you're not trying to shoot whole videos off of it. It's a glorious, glorious battery life champ in a way that Apple really can't compete with runtime. All of the iPhones are more powerful. Great. Easy win. but you exhaust that gas tank pretty damn quick. And Apple is still almost criminally negligent in putting adequately sized batteries in their phones. So, just that little bit of holiday bitterness as we close out the year. It was really fun just kind of mixing it in. Like I literally said at the top, I'll be the Android whipping boy. Let's play this game. Because I'm so tired of, the AnTuTu score means nothing. I don't use AnTuTu for work. I don't play games in AnTuTu. A bigger number in AnTuTu barely starts the conversation. It's not even good at that because you can't compare AnTuTu scores against different platforms. Like they're not meaningful comparisons. Look at a bigger number on an iPhone and a smaller number on an Android means nothing. It literally does not mean anything in how those two are, and to themselves. Like you cannot directly compare the scores on different platforms. The benchmarking is only for like one comparable against the same platform. So it would be nice. It would be nice if we could kind of get away from this really lazy and obnoxious way that we talk about techie stuff.
Hey, podcast listeners, I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Tech loving mama, I'm so late, but I was glad I was able to pop in and say hi. Wish you all a happy and safe holiday. Everyone say happy holidays to tech loving mama. I really appreciate you stopping by. Again, I always appreciate anyone who stops by and catches out the show. McCorcoran 3, I don't understand the S21. It improves with processing power and takes a step back with almost everything else, but processing power isn't the thing we really need. So here, I called this on the Discord when we very, very first got some of the headlines coming out that Samsung might be looking at a price cut for the Galaxy S21. The S21 might come in at $850 instead of the S20, which started at $999. Samsung is a multi-billion dollar corporation with a $10 billion a year advertising budget that needs to be paid for. Samsung is never looking at how can we magnanimously help our consumers save money at the expense of our profits. They're never really looking to cut into that. We know they will copy everything Apple does about a year after they make fun of it. And we know that they're going to pay off those other expenses like component manufacturing and advertising. So I put it out there, and people who are on my Discord, they can back me up. They know I said this. My hypothesis, the Galaxy S21 is not a way to charge less for an S20 series. It is a way to charge more for an FE. The Galaxy S21 will be a more expensive replacement for the Galaxy S20 FE, and then an S21 Plus can be the replacement for the S20, and then the S21 Ultra will be the combination of S20 Ultra and Note 20 Ultra, but you pay more because the S Pen isn't included with the phone. Neither will a charger. So that's how the S21 makes sense. The S21 is going to sell for less than the S20. So Samsung is going to get a bunch of great headlines. Oh, wow, Samsung has come to their senses. They're going to charge less. How great! You can buy the S21 and it's cheaper than the S20 was. And a bunch of lazy, feckless tech influencers are just going to ride the Samsung hype train. But I'm telling you, the S21 is an FE2. It's how do you get someone to pay $100 more for an FE? That's what it is. The plastic back, the different components, they're going to cheap out on some of the camera stuff, and they know they can because Apple now has like three tiers of smartphone and they can just copy Apple's different product lines and strategy and positioning. That's it. That's the game. I called it then, and then we got all of the headlines. After I called that, we got all of the headlines. Oh, the S21 is going to have a plastic back. Nailed it. I nailed it. But it's the same thing. You know, a Galaxy Note 20 really shouldn't exist. The Note 20 mostly exists to pressure people into buying the Note 20 Ultra. It's pain point after pain point after pain point, compromise after compromise after compromise. And if you're already going to spend $1,000, bump it up to $1,300 and get the good phone. It's so cynical. It's such an ugly aspect of like tech and consumerism. Last mug of water, and we should probably start wrapping this show up. But let's kind of chew through a couple more comments here. And so for McCorkran 3, does that mean they won't release an S21 FE? You know, I don't know. You know, we got an S10 Lite and an S20 FE. We'll probably get some lower cost end of the year. Just got to bump up our numbers. But I think what'll happen is they're going to look at how the market responds to the S21. And then from there, they can make some other targeted compromises. And that's really what it is. It's like, how can we take the S21 and make it even cheaper? And that's what we might get for an S21 FE. But I think they're going to keep shifting up. Like, they haven't had a consistent naming strategy for a while. So they can play with a couple parts and pieces. They've got an enormous manufacturing parts bin. They can have a couple phones at the ready, very quickly move. Like, once the S21 sales numbers come in, they can start refining an end-of-year product to ship and to make. Like, this stuff can move pretty quickly when you're an organization of the size and leverage of Samsung. Dave Burns, the FE in 2021 will be made of toothpicks and bubble gum. McCorkran 3, you need to read through like six paragraphs of praise to even hear about the plastic back. But it's going to be cheaper. See, stuff like that bothers me because like the LG V50 is a monster phone. Do I still have mine out here? I think I do. So this is my Korean LG V50. You might have seen it pop up in my Rode Vlogger video because I still feel that the V50 has the absolute best audio recording and processing hardware on any phone I've reviewed, even phones out this year. And it's definitely better than the aggressive noise reduction that the V60 employs. V50 has been sneaking into my videos this whole year. Or I should say footage from the V50 has been sneaking into my videos this whole year because this is still an incredibly powerful workhorse pocket computer that was the last of its ilk from LG in being a no-compromises priced to feature all of the incredible hardware that's on tap. So then the V60 comes out, and it's cheaper than the V50. It is less expensive at launch than the V50. The V50 was legit for its time, a $899? I can't remember what the V50 launched at now. Anyway, comparably priced against a similar tier Samsung device, and then the V60 came out and cut $100 off of that with a top-of-the-line chipset and the new and a 5G radio. Where were all the people going, LG, how magnanimous. What a great plan. LG's reading the room and they're making their phones less expensive. Oh my gosh. Pixel 4 is like starting at like $799, but when you compare the same storage, the Pixel 5 launched like $100 cheaper than the Pixel 4 that it replaced. Where were all of those techies going, wow, what a great move? And they understand the market and they know what consumers are going to care about. Nope. This phone has a compromise. That means you must never buy it. I mean, again, this game is way less fun when it's this obvious. When the manipulation of this content is this obvious. And Samsung's not going to get the same criticisms. It's different when Samsung cuts the price. You know, it's good. It's a good thing when Samsung makes their next phone a little bit not as good as the phone it's replacing, but you save money. So it's good. It's good that you save money. But when anyone else does it, that's a deal breaker. When Google does it with a Pixel, I need to write an angry editorial. The Pixel 5 doesn't even have the radar air gestures that I made fun of on the Pixel 4. Why would anyone buy it if it's less phone for less money? Dave Burns, the backpedaling to make sure everyone is okay with plastic backs now that Samsung has done it makes me really frustrated. If it wasn't okay last year, then why shouldn't it be okay this year? From Tech Loving Mama, I don't mind plastic back. You can still have a very nice looking device with plastic. I don't think glass is better. It's definitely more fragile. I hate we spend all this money for fragile. So I've definitely been on sort of both sides of this conversation, and I'm not trying to have it both ways. But the thing that bothers me is the thing I'm criticizing, and what I feel like Dave Burns is getting at, is we've spent years acting like glass is a premium material. And now very expensive phones, $1,000 phones, are coming out with plastic backs. But because they're from manufacturers like Samsung, well, it's okay to now walk back all of those things that we said about premium. And it's okay. You can get used to plastic again. But what I'd like is plastic that doesn't try to mimic glass, because this is where I'm cynical. Samsung is not making a shiny, glossy plastic because it really is the best material to make the back of a phone out of. They're making it that way so it looks just like the glass-backed phones in marketing stills and in videos, in advertising and in reviews. So they're trying to slip this by consumers. So yes, I would actually prefer more plastics and polycarbs be used, but I want them to read as polycarb. I don't want a soft, easy to scratch plastic on the back of a phone. I want a matte finish colored polycarb, which on all of my Lumia devices, they age much better. Because as you get little abrasions and scuffs and nicks, I never really put Lumias in cases. I just didn't feel the need to. As my 1520 got banged up and dropped and scratched and scraped, the polycarb was yellow. So you just saw more yellow. Like it just chipped away and it was yellow underneath. When you have a glossy, shiny, fake glass plastic, as it gets aged and as it gets worn, it's going to look crappier and crappier. But that's kind of fine if we're talking about like a $400 phone. You know, I've got a Nord, I've got a TCL. We have expectations for $399 that are very different than a Galaxy Note 20 at $999. That bothers me. And it bothers me that the tech review commentary is horrifically inconsistent about how they criticize different manufacturers. So that's the concern. I would love to see more plastic. I would love to see a return to matte finish, polycarb, maybe go Kevlar, give me some wood, even faux wood, like a wood grain texture would age so well on the back of a phone, even if it's not real wood. That's what I want. But they're not giving me that. They're trying to trick unsuspecting consumers into thinking it's the same as the more expensive phone. And that, to me, is insidious. McCorkran 3, yeah, the Pixel was trashed for using less hardware and charging less. Again, it was like, oh, I'm going to compare the Pixel 5 to this other phone. Yeah, but the Pixel 5 is like $200 cheaper. Nuh-uh. I was like, compare a Pixel 5 to an iPhone 12. They're very comparable. The iPhone 12 is going to win for processing power, and the Pixel 5 is going to win for like almost everything else. Similar camera setups, you know, again, the Pixel 5 won't be able to shoot 4K video at 60 frames per second. So that is a bummer. I do miss that feature, but you've got to go and convince consumers at that like $699 price tier that they really care about 4K video at 60 frames per second, which tech influencers act like consumers don't care about that stuff until it helps Apple win a showdown. But basically everything else, battery capacity, storage, price per storage, not only wireless charging, but reverse wireless charging, higher refresh rate display. The iPhone is going to win for speakers. I would definitely say the iPhone wins for audio tech over the Pixel 5. But everything else is either a draw or a win for the Pixel. The price difference is like $200. And you get a fast charger in the box with the Pixel 5. It's like you have to give an iPhone a $200 advantage, a $200 handicap, just to make it a fair fight between a Pixel 5 and an iPhone 12. And that drives me nuts. Because again, as soon as I hear like, well, OnePlus has been beaten at their own game. Look at the iPhone 12. It's such a bargain. Uh-uh. No. Not 5G phone to 5G phone premium tier chipsets. The OnePlus 8T can still easily hang and beat the A13 in processing power. So we should expect the 8T will lose some fights to the A14. No. You've got to spend a lot more on an iPhone 12 to make it match an 8T for all of these different bits and pieces and parts and storage. You know, again, that matters to Apple. Storage is expensive, according to Apple. It's cheap everywhere else, but it's expensive to Apple. It's because Samsung. That's why it's okay. I mean, Nick Fallon, I understand what you're saying. Plastic is dead to you, but I just don't think we can go back to metal. I don't think we'll get back to a true, like, airplane-grade aluminum back. I think the HTC 10 was the last day of that. I think that's truly the last, like, that phone was just so criminally underrated. I don't think we're going to get back to metal back phones. It's just not going to happen. Aw, Goran, I just want an HTC One M7 for 2021. Metal build stereo speakers, front-facing stereo speakers, and then a Snapdragon 700 series processor. That, especially, it was just so cute. It was so little. I remember picking it up and like, oh, this is an average-sized phone. And now you pick it up and it's like, oh, it's so petite. Dave Burns talking some trash about the lightning cables. And all Greg, what the heck is up with no charger in the box? That just stinks. I don't care you trying to save the world or not. Give us a damn charger. It's because it's more money. They make more money. So first of all, there are going to be a whole number of consumers out there that are happy to just continue using the chargers that they already have. Okay. So that argument, I totally get it. But when you're shipping phones, if you can reduce the size of the box, you can ship significantly more phones on the same pallet. So Apple has effectively cut their shipping costs by a significant margin because they can stack almost twice as many iPhones in the same space as they did before. The savings aren't passed on to you. The additional costs of that shipping are passed on to you. Because if you'd like to get the new charger that has the USB-C connector on it, because you're probably coming from a charge brick with a USB-A charger on it, then you get to pay for that extra packaging and the charger that wasn't in the box, while the phone is technically at the same price as the phone that it replaced. It's all about money. Samsung saw that Apple got away with it, because they always do. Having all those headlines, you know, this is that, that, what do they call that? The supercell event, the super something event. Now, so many people have been sitting on iPhones for such a long time that now there's like a surge in iPhone in iPhone sales. And again, it's greater than Apple was expecting. You're like, well, yeah, it's all the right buzzwords. It's the 5Gs and the new form factor. People always buy heavier when there's a new form factor. It looks different, so people know that you spent money more recently. You know, it comes out in different colors and it's got the right sort of flat sides. People, ooh, is that the new iPhone? I have last year's iPhone. I'm poor. I don't know. I mean, like, Heike, so this is one of the things that I don't like doing. Heike asks, what tech sites are the worst in that regard? I mean, that they give Sam Apple unfair advantages in their reviews. I think the problem has gotten so persistent that a number of individual and independent reviewers don't even realize that they're playing into the game. For me, there are troubling trends. When I see a reviewer who used to do more in-depth testing, now only talking about the average consumer experience, but they're still holding up a phone like a Note 20. No, you are hosting a conversation that is designed to appeal to people who have already purchased a phone and are coming to you to have their bias confirmed. When it's a bit more insidious than just, I know I'm giving Samsung an unfair advantage, and that's good for my YouTube ad revenue. I don't think anyone literally sits down to write that script, unless it's like, you know, you're sort of self-identified as like an Apple fan. You know, like, I really like Rene Ritchie content, but I don't go to him for objective commentary. I go to him because he actually does use iOS, iPadOS, and Apple products to a better degree than most other reviewers. So I'll learn something about the Apple ecosystem, but I don't trust him outside of that. Like, I know what his bias is. He's very clear about his bias. I know what to trust him on for that kind of commentary. What I find instead is whenever you see a reviewer criticize a company for one thing, like for example, like LG, you'll see them criticize the V60. The V60 doesn't have a high refresh rate display. Okay. But what does it have? You didn't really use the product. You didn't move beyond just this one criticism. And now you're using that as your deal breaker. And that was lazy. You got lazy on that phone review. Oh, the Microsoft Surface, it only has a Snapdragon 855 and it doesn't even have a good camera. Actually, the selfie camera is fine. It fits exactly in with what you think like a selfie camera should do. I wish I had a rear camera, but there's no way to make it any thicker. It'd be a weird lump that wouldn't fold right into the rest of the phone. But if you're complaining about an 855 when most mid-tier phones and a couple premium phones are using 765s, then you're an idiot. I mean, you're dumb. You're proper bad at tech if you're complaining about an 855 in 2020. So it's that kind of stuff. When you see people move the goalposts around, it's because they're catering to an audience. It's not because they're really trying to keep a consistent analysis. It's that they're trying to make sure a certain audience member, their phone wins. And that's what I find to be so frustrating about what YouTube has created in the review space. Because it's not, can I really be that resource for a consistent approach, even if I have a bias. Like, I'll tell you what my bias is, but can I show you the work I put in to judge all phones by the same criteria? And even then, if I choose a different phone outside of what phone wins in this one benchmark, I have a reason, and you understand what that reason is. No, instead, what it is can I just tell the largest group of people that they're smart for doing the thing that they did, and I can pat them on the back? You'll make way more money that way. You win YouTube when you're good at doing that. And from Dave Burns, you laughed at that. I'm poor, but the social pressure is sad and it's upsetting to me. A better phone does not make you a better person. And in many ways, what I'm upset about is seeing people buy, like in my family, it's like this rash of people who go out to buy iPhone Pros. And I can't figure out why. They do the bare minimum on these phones, like texting, emailing, and like keeping up with Facebook, with the occasional awkward selfie from the front-facing camera. And like I have a cousin who kind of streams some Twitch stuff. I mean, not, like, watches some Twitch stuff, not streaming from the phone. He's not an IRL streamer. He just watches Twitch on his iPhone. So actually, I made a lot of fun of him because he was like watching Twitch, and he was doing in the middle of some Twitch stream where they were doing a contest, and his mom asked him to like look something else up. He's like, "Well, I can't. I need to keep watching the stream." And like, you have a $1,300 phone, and you can't do anything else on the phone while you stream Twitch? What's wrong with you? So he was not happy about my color commentary on his inability to do anything nifty on his $1,300 phone. But again, that's kind of the idea I'm pushing back against. There is absolutely no reason why they should have been on iPhone Pros. They should have been on, you know, iPhone 11. Whatever iPhone 11 Maxes or iPhone 11 Pluses or whatever the bigger iPhone 11 was. But again, it's like, well, I needed to have the bestest. I deserve the bestest. And you're like, it's such a waste. You're wasting money. You're literally throwing money away. And you're not even getting much of a flex out of it. Because outside of a handful of circles, no one cares. Phones are everywhere. Rational people aren't using these as the fashion lifestyle accessory features that people pretend they are. I've got a couple highlighted, and then we should start wrapping this up. From Alice Blackley, a lot of the big sites are very, very biased. The Verge loves to hype up Apple, for example, and then you also have a number of reviewers that literally live in some sort of symbiosis with Apple and earn money and views on the back of the brand popularity. Between two comparable pieces of tech, Apple will almost always be given much more attention and much more media space. It's the brand gravity. That's because Apple popularity as a brand brings money and views as opposed to LG or Sony, which is, yeah, it's kind of the main thesis that I work under. I would much rather spend my year bouncing back and forth between interesting phone fights. Like LG versus OnePlus was really fun this year. V60 versus Xperia 1 was really fun this year. V60 Fold 2 and Surface Duo. That was a lot of fun to put that together with TK. None of those videos did great. I mean, honestly, like my YouTube metrics year over year just keep sort of gently plateauing and descending. And I just don't feel any burning desire to make every single video some sort of Apple or Samsung hype companion piece. And it's frustrating, but it's also just like it's how I kind of still have fun. If I'm not having fun, I'm not doing this. So yeah, it's not so much like I can point to one outlet that's really bad about this. So don't go read them. It's more just you kind of need to be discerning. You know, I love watching I almost said Techno Buffalo, but I love watching John. But I know he has shifted from making an argument about being an objective reviewer to being someone who wants to only talk about the things he likes. I think that makes his commentary more fun, But I also know that I'm not going to him to win some debate or get some insightful hot take. I know that I'm getting entertaining content based on his bias. His bias just happens to line up with the most profitable tech manufacturer on the planet, who's really good for generating views on YouTube. But I kind of feel like he's coming at this from a more honest place now. You know, it's not like, let me review this Motorola and tell you why it's garbage. You know, that's not fun anymore. Matt Tyler saying I need to hydrate. But this totally goes in like, you know, one of the quick articles, and I'm going to have all those linked. You can read those articles. We're not going to talk about them too deeply because I'm already running long for this podcast when I said we should have started wrapping this up, but I digress. You know, like there's a story. Microsoft might be working on their own ARM processors for a future Surface. 2 years ago, I put out a video on Newegg, silly little just poll. We were trying to do these random poll videos. You know, do you like this game or this game? What was the best animated series? Vote in this viewer poll. And I did one on ARM-based laptops over two years ago now. And of course, like, it's a Newegg audience, so a bunch of people are like, no, because I need, like, legacy support and software and power. We were ready for this transition 3 years ago. Consumer expectations for mobile computing and a laptop shell could easily have been tackled by smartphone processors from 3 years ago, and we could have been growing from there. But because of the momentum behind Intel and AMD offering some more exciting competition over the last year, x86 and x64, these more desktop-style chips continued to dominate the manufacturing. They have all this experience. Well, now that Apple has moved over to ARM, now we're suddenly interested in playing this game. And it's so frustrating because Apple wasn't doing it to really shake up the market. Apple was doing it to protect their bottom line. Apple only disrupts their own product lines when it is a way to for them to make more money. Any other company could have jumped on this. Any other company could have had this magical forethought or this magical insight. Any other company could have also said, hey, we want to be able to completely control our destiny, make our own chips, and make sure that we have vertical control over our product line and our manufacturing. We needed to wait for Apple to do it before anyone else took it more seriously. And that's such a pain in the ass. Because now, again, the M1 is a great chip. Apple deserves a ton of kudos for really like putting something competitive out in the market. We've had competitive out in the market for years. These little Snapdragons have been laptop competitive, and people didn't want to hear it. Geeks didn't believe me. They think there's something wrong with my testing protocols. There wasn't. I was right. Merry Christmas. If you take anything away from this rambling podcast, it's that I was right, and I've been right, and YouTube is punishing me for not just towing the line. All right. Let's go ahead and start closing this down. yeah, some good comments here. Matt Tyler talking up TK and Dave Burns talking about transcoding and running on less power and some good stuff, man. Again, I'm glad that some of these ideas are getting out there, but it's just frustrating because I feel like Apple just holds us all back. No one is brave enough. Excuse me. No one is brave enough to take a step outside of what's established until Apple shows them that they can make money on it. And I want more of these companies to have that, the kind of vision that made me excited when I started getting into mobile tech. But anyway, folks, thank you so much for sitting in, hanging in there, having a fun, goofy, nerdy, geeky conversation. I needed this. I needed something that wasn't just railing about tech and politics, especially just all of the stories that are coming out about what's going down in Washington, D.C. right now is just kind of vomit inducing. So I needed to talk about Die Hard. And I'll take it back. Again, if you have not watched my video love letter diary entry to why Die Hard is an amazing Christmas film, give it a watch, because I hope to change some minds on a movie that I think is often only consumed on its most surface level and its most basic level. So from truly a movie I truly adore, and not just because the action is fun and Bruce Willis delivers some witty one-liners and yippee-ki-yay, but genuinely transcends and redefines the action genre while also leaning into themes that I think make it wholly appropriate for Christmas. You'll be able to catch that video on somegadgetguy.com. So we're gearing up. If Christmas is the holiday you celebrate, if you already lit your candles for Hanukkah, if you celebrate Kwanzaa, is it Ramadan? I feel terrible now that I can't remember the winter holiday for some of my closest friends. My family is getting ready to unwrap a bunch of presents under a new artificial Christmas tree. And this Christmas will feel a little incomplete for us not being able to visit with family like we usually do. What's been important for us to remember and for us to consider, we've got some fun gifts under our tree for our five-year-old. And that is not the reality for a lot of people out there right now. More so than in other years past, we've faced challenging times during the holidays. And much more so than some of those other challenges that I've lived through, some of those other scary times that I've been a part of. The spirit of this time of year needs to be honored and remembered. Whatever your sect, whatever your background, religious or a-religious, region, language, cultural background or history, we all generally have some kind of end-of-year pattern or habit or behavior or ritual. And so while the events of the world around us are going to interrupt that, and the realities of just trying to survive are likely going to make this one of the most difficult holiday seasons of my life, for everyone, not just my life, but I mean of this time, it's never been more important to me to share these words as a gesture, as a virtual hug to people out there that might need it. But if for nothing else, I hope you are safe. I hope you are warm. I hope you're well fed. And I hope you get to talk to some people that care about you. And really, if we can make it through the holiday season and we can satisfy some of that criteria, that's got to be enough. That's got to be enough just to get us through. We're kind of seeing some evidence that a light might be at the end of this tunnel, and that a new normal will arrive where we don't have to be as afraid. We can get back out to some business as usual. Everything's going to be changed, but something that resembles what we used to do. We still have some time to figure this stuff out. It's still going to take some time to get this stuff done. But along the way, it's not just surviving. It's still remembering and still participating and still being there for each other and putting out a helping hand and trying to find the things to celebrate with your family and friends. From my family to yours, happy holidays. Thank you so much for being a part of this community, for being a part of these conversations, and the thanks that I'm sure you never adequately get from your family and from your friends. I genuinely appreciate those of you who rise to the occasion of being good tech neighbors and good tech citizens. On that note, I'm going to close this out. I'll catch you all back here next week. And if you're celebrating the Christmas, please be safe, but have an amazing time celebrating this holiday at the end of the year. I'll catch you back next week for another show that'll probably be just as pajama chill and rambling and disjointed as this one was. So be well and take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now,
The smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.